Welcome to another episode of Summer is Coming. I'm your host, Tiny Grimes.
And I'm Dark Nodge. Tiny has finally came out of his cave for a second time. This time he's not going to go back and fall asleep. I think he's actually going to come out and stick with us. You played a game, didn't you, Tiny?
I played like 5 games last night. Not on Octagon, with actual humans. And you know what? It was fun. I remembered how much I loved Game of Thrones last night. It was a good night.
Yeah, sometimes people forget that Game of Thrones has the word game in it, and it's supposed to be fun. You get too competitive, you get too serious. I'm glad to hear that you're having a lot of fun.
One of the things that I realized with Game of Thrones is that because I play Control decks and because I play very seriously, the game is really grindy. You know, you're trying to grind out these small advantages over a number of turns, and if you play those turns really slow, the game just drags on and on. And last night I made a conscious effort to really play quickly, and I allowed myself some mistakes that I normally wouldn't make by playing fast just to play quickly and enjoy the game more. And it really worked. I had a really good time playing the game quickly.
That's awesome. So while you were sleeping again, a new pack came out.
I know. I saw it. I bought it. I put it in my bag, and I'm ready to open it.
Awesome. We should open it now. Maybe go through, take a look at the cards.
Boom. Done. Opened. Let's look at them.
All right. Do you want to just go through each card really quickly and give us your opinion, and I'll see if I agree or disagree with you?
Sure. That seems reasonable.
All right. Do you want to start with Lannister, maybe?
Yeah, why not?
All right. Okay. I think the first card in the pack is Daemon Marbrand. What do you think of this individual? He's, for our listeners, he's 3 cost, 3 strength. He's got 2 icons, intrigue and power. He's a bannerman and a lord, and he has the text that you can discard a card basically to give people +3 strength during intrigue challenges.
My first response is Lannister Bannerman. What are we looking at? Do we have a whole slew of Lannister Bannermen that we're using to trigger this guy?
Sadly, he's the only one right now.
Oh, that's great. So essentially, we're discarding a card to give a dude +3 during an intrigue challenge.
Yes.
I mean, that could be useful with terminal schemes or something like that. I mean, you really do want to win intrigue challenges. You could give it to Cersei to make sure she wins, but feels awfully limited to me.
Yeah, to me he feels like a generic unique, which is okay. Will he see play? Maybe as a one of in some decks, but I don't, you know, I'm not extremely excited about him or anything.
Yeah, he feels like a card that, you know, maybe if by the end of the cycle we get 5 awesome bannermen, and you know, you're getting 3 of them out at a time, and you're able to trigger that and essentially guarantee a terminal schemes, and so you play this really cool removal Lannister deck, maybe that's good. But it just feels like there's so many good choices that he just doesn't quite make the cut.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the next card is similar. It's a strong-ish card in the right type of deck, but overall I don't think it'll see a lot of play, and that's Ashmark. It's a location, it's unique, it's 1 cost, and it has the text, discard a card from your hand to add 1 gold token from the treasury to your gold pool. And it's limited 3 times per phase. So, to me, the thing that jumps out here is that you can use it to, you know, trigger shadow effects. Maybe you could use it for some of that interesting Dom gold, then the Dom deck stuff. But overall, not something I think is going to see a lot of play. What do you think, Tony?
To be perfectly honest, I'm surprised you don't love this card. It feels to me like it was designed for you, that you could do some crazy dominance combo deck, and this would anchor it. You know, you could just play this, and you could actually play a bunch of characters and then still get off the dominance effect. So if you don't like it, we're in big trouble.
Well, I mean, why wouldn't I just play a land that just gives me gold?
Yes, yeah. That's not a bad idea, actually. But this can give you 3 gold by discarding your whole hand.
Yeah, I'm not feeling it.
You don't want to throw away your hard-earned card advantage just for a gold?
No, I don't. Yeah, I mean, if it gave me 2 gold, I'd start considering it. Because I basically, in my mind, equated drawing a card to about 2 gold. And I think I've done that because of a bunch of stuff in Thrones, like the Alliance agenda, where you have that choice. You know, you kneel it to either kneel your house card, to either draw a card or get 2 gold, where you pay things like Gold Tooth Mines, it's 2 gold, and then, you know, the next turn you don't get a card advantage because you're just basically replacing the Gold Tooth Mines, but the turn after you start to get some cards. And so for some reason, 2 gold to me seems to be about the value of a card. And that's the fast calculation I do, I guess, whenever I'm looking at, is it worth it to do X or Y?
Interesting. Yeah. I'll trust you on that one. I haven't done that sort of calculation.
So the next final Lannister card is Trebuchet. It's also a location. It's 1 cost. It's non-unique, so you can have more than one in play. It says discard Trebuchet from play to give each of your participating characters plus X until the end of the challenge. X is the number of cards in your hand. So this can really pump a bunch of weenies up very quickly. So it's interesting in that. However, for me, Lannister has a ton of great locations. I think this could see play in certain decks, but overall, again, I don't see a lot of play. What do you think, Tiny?
Yeah, this is one of those cards that comes out a year ago. I'd probably play it. There are a lot of good Lannister locations. It's really hard to crack a spot. You know, whenever I build a Lannister deck, I'm always thinking, oh my goodness, this deck has way too many locations. And I remember I've played against guys who have like 24 locations out with their Lannister decks, and it's just really difficult to find a slot for this. I think in a specialized deck it could, if you're, you know, focusing on getting Terminal Schemes out or you're running Power Behind the Throne and you really want to push through those intrigue challenges, maybe. I don't like the card that much, though.
I can see it definitely fitting into some decks, especially like a deck similar to what Kyle took to Gen Con, where, you know, it's a Tunnels deck with a ton of draw, where you draw a cap probably after turn one or two, and you have a ton of cards, and somehow they manage to get rid of your Tunnels. You need a way to push through those last few challenges. This card can work in that type of deck. It lets you push through that key power challenge, that key military challenge that you need, because it gives all your characters the X. So even if you have 2 or 3 cards in hand, if you have 2 or 3 characters attacking, you get a lot of extra strength from the card. And it can be recycled easily with the prayers and stuff, but in general, I don't... Sorry, go ahead.
It's interesting that you would say in a Tunnels deck, because my initial thought was, like, the deck that runs a lot of weenies is the Tunnels deck, and you wouldn't need this card in that, but it is interesting that you can give yourself a bit of redundancy for your Tunnels deck. I'd probably run one of these in a Tunnels deck, maybe 2, just to get that redundancy. And that's a lot of strength you can give those weenies.
Yeah, that's the way I would see it too. It's like I'd run it for redundancy, or I would run it if I really, for some reason, need to push through a certain key challenge early game, and this would be a good card to do that.
It kind of makes me think you could run a Tunnels deck without House of Dreams. You could run, say, 2 or 3, probably 3 Tunnels and 2 of these, and you're pretty likely to draw into one of those 5 cards with all the draw you get. I'm not sure it'd be a good idea, but it could free you up if you had some other creative idea that you wanted to do.
Yeah, I could see that if you're running the prayer so that you could recycle your location, those trebuchets as well. Just in case you get 1 out or 2 out, then you can quickly, you know, get them back into play so that even if you don't draw into the tunnels, you'll have a way to keep boosting over and over again the challenge strength.
Yeah, could be interesting.
I think Stark is the next section of cards, and the first card is another Banner Bearer. Moore's Umber is 3 cost again, 3 strength, 2 icons, military and power. He has the text, discard a card from your hand to choose a character. Until the end of phase, that character gets +1 strength for each Bannerman character you control. Now, Stark has more Bannermen than Lannister did. They actually have 1 more. They have, I think, Bannermen of the North, and they also have a location that lets them search out Bannermen in Campfire Lights. Even with all that, I still don't see this guy making it into a lot of decks.
Yeah, so what you're telling me is I can play a location that searches out bad characters to make this bad character slightly less bad.
He's not. That's really what you're telling. I think this character is more interesting than some of the other ones in the fact that he gives a +1 strength for the whole phase. It's not in a specific challenge type, so he's got a little bit of anti-burn tech if you go first. The problem is, Stark has a ton of good 3-cost characters, and on top of that, Stark doesn't have a lot of draw normally, so discarding cards, you know, hurts more, because like in poker, where your chip value is based solely on the number of chips you have in front of you, cards are the same way. So the less cards you have, the more important they are to you. So if I have a min of 16 cards and someone takes two of them from me, I don't cry so much. If I have 3 cards and someone takes 2 of them from me, I start to weep.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. Because for me, what beats Stark is Valoring when they don't have cards. That's how you beat Stark. And this guy just makes it much easier to pull that off. It just is really difficult to get one strength. It would have to synergize really well with upcoming cards, specifically Bannerman or other cards that allow you to really exploit that kind of strength advantage. Right, so we'll have to see. But even so, like you said, the 3-cost slot is really full. You're not taking out Brienne. You're not taking out Lewin. You're really going to have to look hard. You know, is Daemon Dance for me coming out for him? I don't know. You're going to have to find a slot for what looks to me to be a pretty borderline card.
Now, he is interesting in that you can use him on your opponent's characters if you wanted to pump their strength as well.
Right.
And I say he's interesting because of the next card in the pack, which is the Northern Land Keep. It's a 1-cost location, non-unique, and it says, Kneel, Northern Land Keep, to choose a participating character with a higher strength than printed cost. Remove that character from a challenge. So if you wanted, you could have pumped your opponent's characters and then used Northern Land Keeps to get a form of control.
That's an interesting proposition. I mean, you're having to run a bunch of cards just to pull off this effect that you get to do once per turn. And you have to dip, so you have to play locations that you might not normally play. Characters have to come out of your deck to fit this guy. Then you have to discard, all to remove a dude from a challenge. It's like Pantoshi Manor, only terrible.
Oh, I actually think the keep itself is quite good.
I don't know, how many characters are we talking about that are matching this description? Doesn't feel like it's that many to me.
A lot of the armies.
Yes, that's true. It would hurt the armies.
You know, Northern Cavalry Flank's a great example. Some of the newer cards that we see in this chapter pack have higher strength and cost ratios.
Hurt Northern Cavalry Flank that much since they don't kneel.
You can still remove them from any challenge. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. But I just doesn't. It feels like it's a bit too limited. It feels like a meta call. Like if you're seeing a ton of armies, then yeah. But
well, not just armies. Like a lot of the 0 and 1 cost characters also have this, you know, description. Like any of the refugees. I know they're not around anymore, but any of the refugees would fit this. Hungry Mob would fit this. Even Dothraki Handmaidens would fit this. Like there's lots of little guys that have high strength to cost ratios that you'd be able to use this on.
Yep, that's true. Now, what's interesting, and this would rarely come into play, you can choose your own guys and remove them from challenges. So they throw on a surprise deadly, and you can yank your guy out. I don't think that's going to come into play very much, but...
Right, and there's a great example. You know, someone drops he calls it thinking on one of their characters, all of a sudden he is now susceptible to this. You know, if someone tries to bump the strength of one of their characters with one of those other bannermen we saw or some other way, he is now susceptible to this.
True. LIV. It would really hurt LIV, actually, because they're going to lose the bump and the draw from LIV. So,
exactly.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to give this a C. Again, it's the problem of what do you take out for it? And that's what I always think of when I see a new card. It's always what comes out.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting card. I think it's going to be quite good, actually, if people start to play a more control-centered Stark. Isn't that weird? I just said control-centered Stark.
Yeah, I never even knew that existed. So, yeah, if that happens, if the moon collides into the sun, this card is going to be really good.
And then the card after that is Breaching the Wall. This is an event, and again, this synergizes with that Bannerman character in that it says, after you win a military challenge, choose and kill any number of characters with a higher strength than printed cost that are controlled by the losing opponent. Limit 1, limited response per round.
Now, I kind of feel like you've set me up here. So you're like, yeah, this guy doesn't look that good. Oh, the next card synergizes with him. Oh, the next card synergizes with him, too. When you could have just told me that right from the start. So now what we're looking at is taking this as a group and creating a new type of deck in which, is this going to be good? I don't know. I haven't done any testing with it. It feels like you have to like, get a lot of pieces to come together to make this really effective. Like, are you really going to play Breaching the Wall over other great events?
Oh, yeah.
Just because you might have more Zumbra out?
No, because Breaching the Wall is just gorgeous all by itself. And, you know, maybe you play the location that gives everyone who's standy plus 3 strength, and then all their characters qualify, and that's just awesome.
Oh, yeah. No, I like that a lot, actually.
And then all their characters would qualify for this event, so you could wipe their board.
Right. So you could play, like, Siege Deck or something.
Yeah.
Heal all your guys for the military challenge. Play this.
You wouldn't even have to heal your guys, because it doesn't kill your guys. It's the opponent's characters only. So you would just...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
it's really
great.
You know what? I got a whole new deck idea that I'm brewing now. I'm coming around. I'm not sure that Moore's Umber fits into this deck idea, but I certainly like Breaching the Wall now.
Yeah,
you sold me, Dark Notch. Sold me.
There's a lot of ways to pump characters. I played just recently, for fun, I made an alliance to Greyjoy, and I did a bunch of their naval stuff, basically. So I knelt to give pluses to my opponent's characters after I won the military challenge so I could kill them all. with my ships. So, I mean, there's lots of ways to do it, and it can be good fun, and I think the card itself, just by itself in a deck, is really good. I think it's going to give a big boon to Stark. I think we're seeing a trend in this pack. Now, when I first looked at this pack compared to all the other packs when they were spoiled, I was the least excited about this section of cards. Now, the Breaching the Wall was the one card that I was really excited about, but the rest of them I was just kind of meh. And I think that's because Nate French and Damon have done an amazing job of creating a combination of cards that no single card is like, oh my god, that's overpowered. But they've come up with these great new ideas, these interesting design things that, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun for, you know, the year to come.
Yeah, and it's really challenging when you get a game with this size card pool. It really feels like you have two choices. You either power creep it, or you go creative. And power creep is certainly the easy way, right? You can just keep releasing Stannises that do crazy things, and Ashes that don't ever kneel and have renown, and Cersei's. That's the easy way to design, I think. I think it's really challenging to design cards that people are going to use in certain decks that aren't pushing the power creep and aren't being used in every deck.
Yeah, I agree, and I think they did a good job from what I've seen so far in this pack. This cycle, I should say.
Question, why isn't Cersei restricted? Is it just because Lannister is still bad?
Why would you be? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because I feel like Lannister's pretty good, but yeah, if she was restricted, then you'd kind of be in trouble. It just feels like a lot of other really great cards are restricted. Like, Asha just made the list, and to me, Asha and Cersei are the same card. Like, in my mind, they do the same thing.
They're very similar, yeah.
Neither of them kneel for their challenges or for a couple challenges. They both get renown or pseudo-renown. They're both that power-grabby, you answer me now, like this very instant, or you just lost.
Well, I think Asha's better than Cersei for a bunch of reasons. She's cheaper to play. She doesn't kneel. She has renown in all her challenges, not just one type. So in a non-like power behind the throne deck, Cersei isn't as exciting as Asha.
I would agree with that, but Cersei also can do 3 intrigue challenges in a power behind the throne. You can give her stealth and deadly. She doesn't even have to be in the challenge to gain the power.
I like that about her.
Yeah, I'm not saying she should be restricted. I'm just saying I find it interesting that as this restricted list grows, Cersei is still not on it. I'm not advocating she should be on it, though.
Right. I don't think Lannister... We're not seeing a lot of Lannister players win, but I think Lannister has 2 very, very competitive builds right now. I think Tunnels is competitive, and we saw that at Gen Con. And I think the Noah Jenna Lannister is super competitive as well. We didn't see a lot of people playing it, but we saw... I think I saw 2 people playing it. And there could have been others, obviously. But one of them made top 16. So, I think there's a very strong build there as well.
I'm not sure I know too much about that build, but I think that is a topic for the next podcast. We should continue with our chapter pack review.
All right. We're on to Martell. Edric Dane. So another House Dane, obviously. He's a Bannerman. And he has the text, discard a card from your hand to choose X characters. Until the end of phase, those characters gain immune to events. X is the number of Bannerman characters you control. He's 3 cost, 3 strength, and a intrigue and military icon, my 2 favorite icons. And unlike the other houses, Martell has a ton of Bannermen. And when I say a ton, they have 3 others. So they have the Starfell Bannerman, they have Dagus Manwoody, and they have the Banner of the South.
The effect is actually really good. Immune from events, depending on the meta. If it's a really heavy Targ meta, that could be extremely useful. It removes a lot of their abilities. I'm not really sure what to say on him in the end. I don't feel like you're probably just splashing him into every deck. He's missing his Noble Crest, so you're not playing him in a Gas and Gray deck, which is where he'd be really useful, so they can't burn down all those nobles. But I imagine he goes in a House Dane deck.
And I think they probably did a very conscious design decision not to give him that Noble Crest, because I think if they did, he'd be too powerful.
I agree. I'd be playing Gas and Gray again tomorrow.
Yeah.
If I was playing tomorrow.
So the next Martell card is the Southern Stronghold. This one is a 1-cost unique location with a gold and an influence, and it says any phase, discard a card from your hand to stand Southern Stronghold. So this basically is a golden influence for 1-cost, which is already a decent card in my mind. Lots of people already play similar cards. And now we have
better chambers.
Yeah, now we have this extra little effect. I think you're going to see this in, I'll say, 80% of the Martell builds.
I think so, too. I don't see any reason why not to. I mean, even if you're not playing a trigger its effect, it's useful, and then you're threatening always that one more influence. You have a red keep still standing, and this is knelt. You're threatening Westeros Bleeds. Your opponent still has to play as if you have a Westeros Bleeds, and that those kind of options that you have, even if you don't really have them, are really useful for screwing with an opponent.
Yeah, you know, you have one other influence. You use this to remove some icons with, one of the Martell events, and they still have to worry about Red Vengeance.
Yep, I like it.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
I'm going to give it a thumbs up.
You know what? Me too. That's 2 thumbs up.
Boom.
I think the only other card so far I've given a thumbs up is Breaching the Wall.
I think I give it a thumbs up. I really have to think about that card still. It looks like it's... I see how it's a Dark Notch card. I'm just not sure it's a tiny card.
All right, so Poison Dwell is the next Martell card. It's a 0-cost attachment, attaches to locations, and it has the text, attached to a location, response after attached to locations, attract is triggered, return it to the owner's hand.
I don't know what I think about that. Trying to think of how many locations are triggered that are so expensive that it's a problem for them to replay. It certainly doesn't do anything to the reducers. I mean, it's good against Iron Throne, I guess, which is really a pain for Martell to deal with. It feels, without going through the card pool, to be a bit too limited to want to play in a deck.
I am really not excited about it.
All right, well, there we go.
All right. So we're going to move on to Baratheon then. We have Alistair Florent. He's a Bannerman, 3 cost, 3 strength, power, and military icon. And again, you can discard cards to get +3 strength, and this time it's during power challenges.
Hooray! Moving on.
All right. We have Brightwater Keep.
This card I really, really like.
Oh, you've already seen it, obviously, then. So
This is the one card I'd seen. The one I'd seen, a friend of mine had it last night, and he showed it to me, and he said, you're building a Bear Recursion deck, huh? You're going to like this card, and I must agree.
I do love it. After a card is discarded from the player's hand, kneel the Brightwater Keep to return it to its owner's hand. Wow.
Yeah,
just wow. You can pay all kinds of costs to kneel this baby.
Yeah.
I wish it had attachments, but it's got the no attachments, which is so sad because I would give this thing Vigilance so fast.
Yeah, I think it's good on both ways. It's good because you can't give it Vigilant, and they can't wreck it also. So it's really hard for them to Frozen Solid it so that they're taking away your ability. I really like it. It's great against the stuff that you're already weak against. It's good against Lannister. It's good against Martell. It reduces how many cards you're losing. It's so cool for the Fury card, so you can stand a dude, get your card back. It's just phenomenal. I really, really like it.
Then we have a neutral card, but it really only works for Baratheon, so Into the Breach, where it is any phase, put a Baratheon character into play from your hand. At the end of the phase, if that character is still in play, discard it.
It's interesting. I actually like it. My thought is something like Fiery Kiss is really good because you can just surprise people. All right, there, Stannis, he's back. All I needed was, you know, the three power that Stannis is going to get. With Melisandre's schemes, with Dale Seaworth, the card can come back to you, so it's not a permanent discard. I'm not sure how much I like it. I'll have to see.
It combos well with things like Bounded by Blood, where you can, you know, Into the Breach and then Bounded by Blood and switch out the characters, and then the character doesn't end up getting discarding because he's back in your hand. Stuff like that. So they're fun Barrow stuff. So I can definitely feel the Shaggy in me in there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. It feels like it could be useful in some sort of combination. I don't think it's going to be the most efficient use of an event slot.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to Greyjoy. I'm getting tired. It's time for you to read some cards.
We got Gorald. What the heck is his name? I don't know.
Gorald Goodbrother.
Gorald Goodbrother. Bannerman Lord, 3-3, military power, any phase, discard a card from your hand to choose any of X locations. X is the number of Bannerman characters you control. Again, discarding a card, what's Greyjoy's weakness? Draw. Yeah.
But that is some pretty nice location control.
I agree, but you do have newly made Lord already. So the question becomes, can you afford to discard cards to do this? I'd rather use Theon Greyjoy if I'm going to Neo locations.
Sure, it does combo with stuff like Scaling Ladder. Right?
Okay, well, I guess we've got to read Scaling Ladder then.
That's it, I think so. So
all right.
Scaling Ladder is an attachment you put on locations. It says, while attached location is knelt, its controller cannot declare defenders during military challenges.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So this would work really well if you think Stark Siege is going to be wrecking your meta. That would really crush them. Regular Stark as well. But yeah, that's an interesting combo.
Yeah.
But again, it's like the last combo. It takes a lot of card slots. And you have to discard in a house that cannot afford to discard. So it's a really costly combo, which I like. If you're going to do something as punitive as they can't declare defenders during military challenges, it should be a pretty costly combo.
Yes, but it's one of those ones that's like right on the verge. It's like, well, we're going to have to build a deck to see if this would work out, yep. Which I like. I think it's
interesting. My gut says no, but your gut probably says yes because our guts are polar opposite.
No, my gut's actually with you on this one.
Oh, that's too bad.
Going with no, yeah.
Sorry, our guts are BFFs now? That's cool.
No, definitely not. But in this one case, I'm gonna side with you, Tiny. I'm going to think that we're not going to see some crazy combination where they're going to be using, you know, discarding cards to get their military challenges through for free.
Challenge accepted. I will be playing a Scaling Ladder deck at Worlds.
I'd love to see that.
a side event that doesn't count for anything.
Yeah, exactly. On the last chance tournament, right?
There we go. There's my Scaling Ladders combo card. All right, well, let's move on to Hammerhorn. Location, stronghold, no attachments, one cost, unique. The player with the most cards at his or her command at the beginning of the draw phase draws one less card to a maximum of one when he or she draws for that phase. All right, the way I view this card, every Greyjoy deck I run, and maybe there's a different deck out there, focuses on its ability to put out amazing cheap characters by the truckloads. This card works in direct opposition to that kind of deck. Plus, Knights of the Hollow Hill decks are going to celebrate wildly when you see when they see you play this, I have a real problem with this card, and I don't really think I'll be playing it.
I don't think it'll see a ton of play in Greyjoy. Do you think it might see out of house play?
That could be. I immediately saw this and went, Knights of the Hollow Hill. Oh, it's Greyjoy. Oh, well, I guess that's not going
to
work.
Well, wouldn't it be great to play it in the Knights of Hollow Hill deck?
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. You could play it in So just to be clear, this is a Dark Knight idea. Tiny wouldn't do this. This is a Dark Knight plan. Doing something crazy like playing this in a Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill deck just so you get extra draw.
What? Greyjoy can't run Knights of the Hollow Hill?
Go ahead. Run it.
I'm just saying, I think it's interesting. I don't think it's the best card in the world. I don't think we're going to see it in a ton of competitive decks, but I think it's interesting. I think it's fun.
It's a cool card. Like, I like that the cards that I don't like in this pack are interesting and could be somewhat foundational for a deck. Like, you could build around this. Personally don't think it'd be a great deck, but it's kind of cool that you could build a deck around it.
And I think until someone does, we might not know. We might be surprised.
Yep.
Maybe John Bruno will be playing it at Worlds, and people will be like, what?
Whoa, don't be revealing Bruno's secret tech live on the air. What are you doing, man? He's going to be really upset.
I'm sorry. We'll edit it out later.
Oh, I doubt that.
Move on to Targaryen.
That sounds good. We've got Sir Raymond Derry. 3 cost, unique, 3 strength, military power, Bannerman. Uh-oh, we already know this is going to be bad. Let's continue. He is a knight, though. Any phase, discard a card from your hand to put an attachment of cost X or lower into play from your hand. X is the number of Bannerman characters you control. Wow. So you'd have to have 2 Bannermen to do a Flame Kissed. I don't know. Maybe Dark Knowledge has a cool Dark Knowledge trick how to make this guy not awful.
You could sunstroke people with this guy.
Ooh, there you go. See, I knew he'd have something.
Yeah, that's. That's fun. A surprise sunstroke is pretty good.
Yeah, no, I could see that. Surprise sunstroke.
Yeah.
It costs 0, so. Actually, does it cost 0?
Cost 1.
Cost 1. So 1.
Well, he's a Bannerman, so he works. Yeah.
Yep. Which is just him. So you have to discard a card to play it. So it costs a card to play sunstroke. That sounds like a Dark Knowledge plan to me.
Well, you could discard it, and then you could run the out-of-house new barrel location, kneel that, and then the card you discard would just come back to hand.
Yep, sounds like you got a Worlds deck.
I think he's actually okay. I think we might see him appear in a few certain decks, but yeah, he's not, oh my god, run home. I give him a neutral rating.
I'll give him a negative rating, but not a damnation rating. Just a, he's a little bit negative. Maybe someone can impress me. I mean, I have been out of the game. Maybe someone has some really cool idea brewing, and then they're going to abuse him, and I wouldn't be that surprised.
Our next card in Targa is Castle Derry.
Okay. So now this is where you punk me? Is that what's happening here?
At the end of the standing phase, claim 1 power for the house if you control more attachments than each opponent.
That's not that great. Claim 1 power.
Yeah, I would be more excited if it was more than 1 power, but... it's 0 cost, so it's not like it's a big investment.
It is an investment because it's a slot.
Yeah, but I think it would generally get you 2 or 3 power or something in a game, right? Targ burn?
Maybe. In my Targ burn decks, I don't have attachments hanging out. I use Flame Kiss to kill people rather than let them sit there and then possibly get discarded.
You never put any attachments on your own guys?
Rarely. I usually save my attachment slots, which are ultra valuable for negative attachments. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe there's a non-burn deck in which this works. But to me, when I look at Targ right now just screams burn. And if you're not playing burn, I'm kind of shaking my head at you. But maybe you have some fantastic, cool deck that could exploit this. And if you do, cool.
Since you just said that, I'm going to predict at Worlds... Dothraki.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it's a solid deck right now.
Didn't their key card just get errated?
What was their key card?
The one that searches out more Dothraki?
I think it got errated because they were too good with it, where you could search out unlimited Dothraki and just keep dropping them into play. Like, broken good.
Okay, so your prediction is they go from broken good to just regular good.
Right. Yeah, I think they would be. I think they're competitive right now, and mm-hmm. I think they'll be competitive at Worlds still.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, there's too
how much advantage this gives you, though. I mean, you're really going to run a bunch of attachments just to get this going?
No, I'm not. I'm actually not even probably going to run that in a Thraki deck at all. But you just said that, you know, you probably wouldn't see the Thraki. So I just had to make a comment directly. You know, Targ, if you would only play Burn, I'm saying you could play the Thraki too.
So you're still saying you don't think anyone would play this card. And we're doing a chapter back review. So let's not call me out on other things. Let's just stick to calling me out over cards.
All right. Well, you were right about the card then. Next.
There we go. I like those words. You were right.
Rain of Fire.
All right.
It's an attachment. It's an event. Play only if you control at least one printed dragon character. Challenges, discard all attachment cards from play. Then discard the top card of your deck for each attachment discarded by this effect.
This seems to me to be a meta card. If negative attachments become really strong, maybe...
Or positive ones.
What is the positive one? Oh, yes, positive ones on there. It's true. If attachments become really huge and you'd rather not use your brothel to do it, which seems way easier, then sure, use an attachment. Use a beloved event slot to remove attachments when you could do it with a Dragon Thief or with a Brothel.
I have to agree with you. You know, you need to have a printed dragon in play, which kind of makes this less exciting. If it didn't have that, then I could see it having some play. But with that, it's like, it wasn't an amazing card before they had that restriction. Now with it, not so excited about it.
Yeah, and it has to be printed as well, so you can't even bestow the dragon. Yeah, so that's even rougher.
So the next card is a plot. It's Rally Cry. When revealed, choose and discard one character or location with cost X or lower controlled by the player with the most cards at his or her command. X is the combined number of plots in all players' used piles. You must be pretty excited about this.
I don't really know what to think of this. I like it. I feel like it's going to be amazing in a couple decks, like in a Targ Jumper deck. This card alone could resurrect Targ Jumpers.
Yeah, I think any Knights of the Hollow Hill could use this pretty effectively after a few turns.
Yeah. Yeah, you couple this with March to the Wall, and now you've got back-to-back plots where you're discarding guys. That could be really, really strong.
Yeah, and I could see this as a nice plot in the Greyjoy deck you were talking about, where you have a whole bunch of weenies on the board. Maybe you Valed, you kept your presence, or you start to lose presence because he's got a ton of cards in hand, like a Choke, and you can use this to kill the one or two characters that he actually has out on board, since cards at your command count the cards in the person's hand.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that could work really well for Greyjoy then, since they often are low on cards. Like a post-Valor situation. Might be even better for Stark post-Valor.
Yes, I agree. I think Stark players will probably start including this, or at least trying it out in a couple decks.
Yeah, the problem is it doesn't say it cannot be saved. So I was originally thinking you could use it as like a way to basically march to the wall a character. So it's not quite as good as I was originally thinking, but it still looks pretty strong.
But it is discard, so that's usually harder to save from. There's less things that'll save from discard than kill in the game.
Yep.
So I like it. I love the idea that the developers are starting to look at the meta, and I think one of the issues with the meta was that when someone falls behind, it's really hard to get back out from being behind. And, you know, doing things like this plot starts to help people come back from being behind. Mm-hmm.
The problem with that notion is that you are putting cards in your deck because you think you're going to be behind. So if you think your deck is going to be behind, why the heck are you running that deck?
Well, there's a few decks, actually, that I think have a hard time, you know, early game in turns two or three, and they need a little bit of help before they can solidify their control, for instance.
Yes, I agree with that. But so, I think that's different than saying, like, a Baratheon Rush deck that gets behind can now play this and be fine. I think they're still boned at that point.
Oh, yeah, I agree. They're still boned at this point. But I think there's a bunch of decks where you know, maybe a Bracken control deck that was using Shadows with their cells, that's a really slow build. Maybe something like this might give them that little nudge that they can start playing that type of deck. Probably, like, I don't think this alone will do it, but, you know, as long as we keep seeing cards like this, something might happen.
Yeah, I agree. It's certainly possible. I really think it might become an auto-include in Knights of the Hallowhill decks. It just seems to be an absolutely natural inclusion in them, which is funny because Hallowhill decks are already really good. I don't really think they needed a bump that, you know, a card that's basically like, if you're running the Hallowhill agenda, you get this huge advantage.
Well, it can backfire. It's not useful turn one probably at all. It's not useful. Turn two, it's probably not that useful. Turn three is when it gets useful, but by then, Knights of the Hallowhill, in most cases, have established dominance, and they might actually have more cards at their command.
Yeah, you're gonna have to play the deck a little bit differently. Like, I don't think it would be as good in Martell, where they're trying to get a ton of draw with the scavengers. But I think in a Targ Hallowhill deck, where that isn't the case, you know, you're not getting just hordes of cards, and you can get rid of them, right? Like, you can play. So it could combo really well with something like Forever Burning. You just hide your Forever Burnings in your dead pile. You play this. You take out whoever you want. Then during your dominance phase, you get them back for the next turn when you play your threat. I think this is just a natural inclusion in a Targ Jumper deck.
Yeah, I can see it in Targ for sure.
And I think I'm going to build that. Like, I'm going to immediately now go build a Targ Jumper deck with that card because now I have Marched and that card and Valor. I have a lot of ways to get rid of their characters while mine are coming back to my hand.
All right. Here's the last card, and it is the other card that I am really excited about in this pack. Storm the Gate. This is an event. It's House Baratheon or Greyjoy only. And it reads, Dominance. Kneel 3 influence or pay 3 gold to discard all kneeling characters from play.
Wow. In Baratheon. That is really going to turn Baratheon around.
Yeah. Isn't that awesome?
Or Greyjoy. Interesting. I don't think it works as well with Greyjoy.
But, I mean, just simple things like a Baratheon player makes you go first. Are you worried now? Like, are you going to kneel out?
Yeah, like, can you ever kneel out? Because the problem is Baratheon isn't telegraphing this very much because they're already running Fury. They're already running King Robert's Hammer. They're already running Stannis. They're already running all of these guys that are coming back.
Yeah, they're standing.
Standing back up. And now you're just like, hey, I'm just doing my normal Baratheon thing. You want to roll the dice or not?
Yeah. I'm just running Knights. I got a ton of influence because Knights always runs a ton of influence.
I mean, I'm playing the recursion deck. I'm playing to see who is stronger. I got all the stuff. You want to roll the dice or not? Yeah, that's a really interesting card. I had not seen that card. I haven't heard anyone talk about it even. That card has me excited. My Baratheon is coming together really a lot better because what they need is some control. Recursion alone I didn't feel like was enough. This is better because now you could play this and Westeros Bleeds and play like some insane recursion deck.
Yeah, absolutely. You can play, you know, people are talking about Baron Knights of the Hollow Hill as being a very good archetype now. I think they're absolutely correct. But I think this can be played really great out of Knights. I mean, the old, the European Knight style build was more of a pressure build than a rush build where they basically use blockade and stuff to slow down their opponent. They use a little bit of control elements and they just won over time. You know, they got their draw elements going. So now you might be able to see some non-European style where you're not using blockade, but you're using more of Baron's control elements in a Knight build, and this would be definitely one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I really think you could just play this in a regular Baron recursion deck, and they just don't really know what to do.
I would agree. I think in a regular Baron recursion deck, it's fantastic too. As long as you can disguise the influence, it's great.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't even think you necessarily need to disguise it. Are they really just never going to ever kneel their guys the whole game? I'm not sure you can get to a win condition that way.
No, you can't. Yeah, they would definitely have to kneel their guys at some point.
Yeah, so, and think about it this way. The longer they wait to start kneeling their guys, the better chance you have that you've drawn into it.
Yep.
I mean, this is a brutal, brutal card. You cannot paper shield it. Well, are we going to see everyone running Hand's Judgment now at Worlds just because of this card?
Or Confession or something, possibly, yeah. So, yeah, big thumbs up.
This is a Meta Warper right here. Wow. Okay. Yeah,
I think this card single-handedly brings Baratheon back up to tier 1.
I really like how you slow-rolled it on me, too. You had us go through the whole pack, and then you're like, oh, by the way, here's an absolute Meta Warper at the end. See, yeah. See if you notice.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm real, real impressed with this card. This is now my new favorite card in the pack.
Yep, it's quite good.
Yep. All right, man. Well, thanks for dragging me out of the cave, showing me the new chapter pack, getting me to open it. I'm going to play with it this coming week. I will. You heard it here first, SoCal people. I'll be playing a Bear Recursion deck this week.
So, Alex, it's been a big week. We just came back to one of the largest events, I guess, in the year for North America. What'd you think of it?
Is it actually the largest Game of Thrones event ever in North America? I know the European ones are regularly larger than that, but I don't know if even in the CCG days they had these numbers.
I think the 104 that happened to arrive and play Game of Thrones at Gen Con was the largest ever. It was a great field. We had some of the top players, not only in North America, but we had people coming in from other countries as well. It was really fantastic.
Chileans. We had some, we had people from elsewhere. We had people from Canada, strangely enough.
In fact, you're listening to two people from Canada right now. If you didn't know, Alex is also a fellow Canadian, which is one of the reasons I roped him into this. We thought we'd take a seriously Canadian vibe to summer's coming this week.
Yeah, but don't hold that against us.
And also, Alex did quite well at the tournament. He placed in the top four at Gen Con. Congratulations on that, by the way, Alex.
Well, I had exactly as many losses as you did. I just had them at better times to have them.
That's a lot of the importance of a tournament. You know, I find that the good players make the cut, and after that there's, you know, some matchup luck and a little bit of luck in your deck. You know, if your deck craps out on you, or if
you face Eric Butzlaff.
You have a great
record there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I always beat him in Swiss, so that's good. I seem to not be able to beat him.
That's worse, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a horrible taste, actually. For those listeners that don't know, I have faced Eric 3 times on the top 16 cut for major events, and I have lost to him each and every time.
I believe it's actually Dennis's strategy that now you should be sending Hookers and Blow over to their hotel room the night before a major tournament.
Yeah, it's my only hope, I think.
It's your only hope.
It's my only hope. So let's talk a little bit about Gen Con. This was your first Gen Con, wasn't it, Alex?
This was my first Gen Con. This is my... it's quite intimidating at first. It's a very big room, a lot of people, and a very big tournament.
What do you think about the convention in general? Like, stepping back from the thrones, exterior from the actual tournaments, what do you think? You know, you went out drinking a few nights, I'm sure, with the AGOT crew. You saw the rest of the convention. What do you think?
First of all, Indianapolis is a city that is really built to handle the convention. The streets are easy to navigate. It's easy to find parking, hopping from a bar to another, from a hotel to another, from the convention to places where you can get food. All of that is effortless. It's well signed. It's easy to get around. And I think that makes the city extremely welcoming. And, I mean, there are two conventions going on at the same time, one Gen Con, and there's a motorcycle convention as well at the same time. And then the city doesn't feel packed or crowded. It's really quite impressive on that end.
Yeah, I also find that the police and a bunch of volunteers actually do a great job, too. They're really helpful. You know, they'll point people in the right direction. Maybe you had a few two beers, you get lost, you have to ride a cop car back to your hotel, Dennis.
Or an ambulance back to your hotel, as another Thrones player found out. Well, not to the hotel, I guess. Something else starting with an H.
Yeah, the hospital. It's really a little bit crazy. For those that don't know, one of the Throne players may have drank a few too many beers and woke up in an ambulance with a dislocated jaw and got to visit the hospital.
But there's the best part of that story, being a Thrones player and how detail-oriented we all are. He refused admission to the hospital. There was a typo on the admission form.
Yeah, I believe the word "and" was misspelled.
That's right, the word "and" was misspelled. So I don't know what happened to the actual dislocated jaw. Maybe we'll have to get Sandy on some other time.
Yeah,
to hear the story firsthand.
And honestly, you know, as a Canadian, I don't know why you would ever not accept a mission into a hospital. I'm guessing in the States it's due to cost or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's another world.
Yeah, another world. So I also thought the convention was great. You know, it's always good just to walk the dealer halls, take it all in, play a couple other games outside of Thrones, have lots of beer. And if you've never been to Gen Con, I highly recommend it. It is just so much fun, totally worth going at least once, if not, you know, every year like I myself do. But let's talk about Thrones, Alex. So we actually both took the same deck.
Mostly we started all off with trying to predict the meta, which... You know, we didn't have a lot of time to do with the FAQ radically shaking things up about, what was that, 3 weeks before the tournament?
Yep. Yeah, it didn't have a lot of time for a lot of people to build their tournament decks. And we took a deck that you had built, Alex, which was a Greyjoy Black Sails that was focused on basically a ton of kill events at the time. It was kind of your version of a Wildling deck, I think.
That's exactly what it was. You had won a regional with your Wildlings deck, and I said, well, then I think I can do everything that deck does except better out of Greyjoy. And that may not quite be true, but it was our starting point for that, yeah.
Yeah. So we took that, and we play-tested it a bit, and we said, okay, well, let's try, you know, the big armies with Intimidate, let's try the fleets, let's try this and that. And while we were doing these many iterations to see which one would work out the best, we started playing with the host. And
well, you started playing with the host. Take full credit for it. The hosts and the manning the city walls came entirely from you, and you slaughtered me about, what, five times in a row in the mirror match. And we said, hang on a second. Clearly, you're onto something.
Yeah, the hosts were just extremely powerful in so many matchups. So we just said, okay, this is the one we're going to go with, and that's when we really started to serious playtest. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, a lot of hours didn't go into my deck. I can't say that about the deck we played. We put in a ton of hours building that deck.
We certainly did. It was a deck, I think, mostly because it's a deck that winds up being a lot harder to play than it looks like at first glance. You're thinking Greyjoy, and you're thinking, okay, I'll just cancel everything they do to mess up my plans, and I'll hit them with Claim 2, and the game will be over. But when you're playing Black Sails, every time you're looking through your hold, you're essentially doing the same thing you do every plot phase, where you're thinking out the entire turn in advance and thinking of every card in their deck or every plot deck, and you're really, you have to pick out the right answer or you're wasting your agenda entirely.
Exactly, and you have to know what plot they're going to turn next, what they're going to do, how you're going to react. You're going to say, okay, is it time to get a save? Is Val coming next round? Or are they going to try to, you know, push a rush? Do I have to get some counter to Renown?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a plot deck, you're looking at seven choices or six choices after the first turn, and your hold, you're looking at 36 in our deck. That's a lot of decision-making every time you get to search through your hold.
Yeah, when we actually first designed the deck, I was extremely nervous about it. And the main reason I was nervous was because I wasn't sure if I could play it for seven or eight rounds because it was so demanding, and surprisingly demanding. I can play one game with it and be fine, and I can play against mediocre, average players, and I'll be okay with the deck. But if I was playing really good players against really good other decks, I had to basically be on my game the whole time. Did you feel like that as well, Alex?
Yeah, the fact that we had so many hours of practice is what made a huge difference. I mean, we really put in so much time on that deck that we started building some of the shortcuts where we knew the Knights of the Hollow Hill matchups, both of those, we knew those very, very well, where we knew the Rush matchups, we knew them very, very well. Because if you really had to make every decision every single time, you would not make it past round four.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember one day where we spent, you know, 5 or 6 hours playing against Hollow Hill, and we were just, how do we beat this deck? How do we beat Martell Hollow Hill? And we were having a huge trouble with it, to the point where we were considering dropping the deck and starting again, and then finally we just said, wow, why aren't we searching out Miramir every single time to start this matchup? And as soon as we did, we started consistently winning to stop those flea bottom scavengers from getting those three draw, and it was a huge change, and I know it seems so obvious now, but at the time, we weren't focusing on always getting Miramir. Little things like that make huge differences.
That's probably the most marked example. I mean, the being willing to sacrifice those plots first turn, being willing to delay your cancels from to be a Kraken just to go search a Miramir, even if he has flipped for Snow of Winter. You know, it's counterintuitive at that point. but when you realize that the entire matchup revolves around who's going to get the draw and who's going to get the card advantage, it makes perfect sense. And then we started winning 75% of the time against that deck. So.
Yeah, and, you know, I expected, personally, I expected some tunnels to make the cut, and they did. I mean, Kyle took a tunnels deck to the cut. That was great. And it was one of the matches we were afraid of, so we ended up putting in King's Law because of it. And I think it was a good...
We tried everything else.
Yeah.
That was one of those matchups that, again, we took hours and hours looking at, and we said, okay, we got to try heavy location destruction and just get rid of Golden Tooth Mines, and that really didn't work. And then we thought, okay, maybe we just need to steal with the Battle for Shield Islands. We need to take the tunnels away from them on turn one or turn two and search it out. And that wasn't working either. There was a game where I got the tunnels away from you on turn one, perfect turn one, and I lost the game because you were drawing six cards to my four. It's just, it is a really strong deck.
Yeah, it was surprisingly strong, and I didn't think there'd be a ton of it, but I thought those people that played it were going to make the cut, and I'm really happy that we played so much versus it, that we were ready for it. I mean, I ended up playing Morgan. She was unlucky enough to have a one-card setup, so it wasn't that much of a game because it was tough for her to come back from that. But I wasn't scared at all when I started playing it because we had played it so much and we were so ready for it. And, you know, I told a few other people, I said, hey, if you're worried about tunnels, you got to do something because, yeah, you might not bump into it in Swiss, but you're going to see it in the cut. And, I mean, Kyle played a great game and you saw him in the cut. And if Morgan had beat me in that that last match, she would have made the cut as well. So,
yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your tournament. So we basically ran Greyjoy Black Sails with a ton of armies and some stand locations to help counter a little bit Lannister, high grounds. So what were the matches that you think, you know, were the best ones you played or the ones that were most interesting?
So I managed, I wrote up a tourney report, which was posted on Card Game DB as, I think, I don't exactly remember what the title was, top four or something like that. My match, definitely the top match, was really unexpected. It was a round four against David Stroms from New York, Vapad on the boards. And he was playing a Targrust Maesters, which is a deck that we tested against often. We have a Fury of the Kraken as our opener against them. We have a huge amount of pressure we can put on them from that. The targeted kill from the plot itself with targeted discard. So it's really not a matchup I was afraid of. And the opening was perfect. I had Fury, I wound up, I had Victarion on the board, I had Claim 2 plus the discard. I wound up attacking with Victarion's Reavers and getting another location off the board as well. He was down to a location and a measly little dragon. Turn 2 was going well as well. And then suddenly, he pulls out Duped Marwyn, he pulls out his standing locations and starts to flood the board. He's trait manipulating. Victarion's gone because he... Kneels Marwyn, Copper Lynx, Victarion, draws a card with his Valyrian Steel Link, and happens to Jorah. And I'm just going, oh, this is starting to turn. And it was really wound up being a hard-fought game where he hit 13 power with one chain on him, and I wound up letting him get to 14 power and get the last chain off. And then I pulled a challenge through with Euron and hit 15 power. But that was the comeback match. And it really, the card that turned it around was finally drawing into a Bastard, which we have in there as a Silver Bullet, and was so neat was that the first time I sat down to face them, I shuffled up my deck and split it and looked through my hold, and Bastard was there, which is where you want it. That's the easiest place to get it. And then that round was canceled because they had to reseed, so then they reseeded, and I was still facing him, and I looked through my hold, and I go, wait, no Risen from the Sea in my hold. No Bastard in my hold. I'm going to have to draw all of those tricks. And so it wound up being turn six, but I drew into Bastard, and I finally managed to turn the tide. It was just a fantastic match. And he wants a rematch, and I'm inclined to go over to New York to give him because he played a great game, and I'd love to do that again.
So you talked about, you know, we had a silver bullet in the deck, and we had a couple silver bullets. I think the host was a silver bullet event against a lot of rush decks. We had Bastard. Now, a lot of deck designers and builders think that, you know, putting silver bullets into a deck is not a good idea. I don't personally believe that. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I think it's even if it were a bad idea in many other decks, in a Black Sails deck, it definitely isn't. So we worked with the numbers quite a while. We pared the deck down to 72 cards, and we felt that's what we were comfortable with. And the idea there is that there's a 50% chance that your one-of card is going to be in your hold, and you're never going to see it if you don't want it. And if you do need it, you're able to search it. So that's half the time. And the other half of the time, you're going to draw into it before the end of plot 4 or 5, depending how things are going, but you're only ever going to see one copy. And so you're really looking at this point where if you need it by turn 5, you're probably going to get it one way or the other. And if you don't need it, there's this, basically a 75% chance that you'll never see it, the 50% chance it's in the hold, and the 25% chance you're not going to draw it by then. So you're really not crippling yourself with a dead card.
You actually did the math before we started deciding to include some of these silver bullets. And I think things like the host, they're not really a silver bullet. They're great against any type of deck. Like, I can't think of a single deck where I would put down the host with Main City Walls and go, damn, I got a host. They just happen to have great counters versus certain types of decks. So I think the only card that ended up being a true silver bullet was Bastard, but we had a lot of other cards in the deck that we knew that if we played this card versus this match, we basically got to win. But they were good against a whole bunch of other matchups.
Yes.
And the math was the key. You know, in a normal 60-card deck, I don't think I go and include, you know, a Bastard for that one case because you probably never see it. And if you do see it in a bunch of matches, it's not useful to you. But in Black Sails, I agree with you, Alex. I think it's really, really good to include, I win if I draw this card versus you stuff.
Yep. And that's what happened in that match of the day. So it's certainly not regretting having Bastard in there.
So this was your second tournament. You got to the top four. Your one before that, you had played in Montreal, which you had won a regional. So that's a pretty nice starting for your tournament life. You've been playing for about a year. Is that correct?
A little over a year. So I was at Worlds last year, and there I didn't make the cut. So I've been improving, I guess, which is a good direction to go in. So this was my third actual tournament in person. With no local meta, that's basically my only chance to shuffle up cards and realize how much bigger they are in real life than when you're playing over Octagon.
So you play primarily on Octagon, and basically that's what I was trying to get at. I think one of the things that a lot of the old school players and a lot of the new players underestimate is how many games people can get in Octagon, and because of that, how much faster they've become really good players. And, you know, we'll say 4 years ago, you would play maybe one game a week with your local meta. And now with Octagon, you're playing 3-4 games a week if you want, you know, taking a half hour here or there. And you're improving so much faster. And I think what it's done is it's made the overall meta way more competitive.
I think it also has allowed you to get access to players who are playing completely differently from you. They're not your play group. They're not always playing the same deck that you know they built last week. Today you might be playing someone from Australia, and tomorrow someone who just won the Polish tournament, you know, whatever the case is. You get a lot of different play styles, and so you have to be ready, just like in a tournament, for almost anything.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about my Gen Con experience. I also, like you said, I've won 5 out of 7 games. It started off really bad. I lost to Dennis in the very first round, and as everyone knows, losing the first round in a major event is basically as bad as it can get, because it means you basically have to win every single one of your other games to make the cut.
And losing to Dennis makes it worse.
Yeah, that guy, man. And it was horrible. I didn't draw a single naval icon when we started off, so I never got to search my hold versus him. I didn't even marshal for 2 rounds because I didn't draw characters. I had, you know, both our Die by the Swords, both our Seductive Promises in hand. He's playing a Knights of the Hollow Hill, and I'm basically crying on the other side of the board. Once I lost, I was really discouraged, but I kept on playing, and I managed to win all the rest of my games from that point on to get to the final cut. And my game of the day was actually versus Eric Butzloff. He won, and he's a fantastic player. You know, he's got couple overall championships, a bunch of regional wins, beats me at every major tournament we go to. But when I played him that day, I felt like I just was playing amazing. I was really happy with my play. I was decently happy with how the deck was going. I just felt like overall that matchup was probably bad for us. And in this one case, even though I felt that I was playing really well, I couldn't come back from that difference in the matchup, which was basically, you know, probably 60-40 or 70-30 maybe, that they would win. you played a couple of these decks, Alex. Did you find?
I played five of the Clinton decks on my way.
Five of them. So did you think that was a bad matchup? The DC Quinton deck was a bad matchup for our deck, or?
Well, so when we tested, we'd actually tested against a Quinton deck that we'd made, and what we found was King Balance Host is just a phenomenal answer to that deck. And so at that point, we played it a couple of times, and we get out the host, and then, you know, the other player would practically resign. You know, their characters lose Vengeful, all those keywords that you see on the knights that aren't knights, you know, the Renown, the Melee, the Stealth, all of that is gone. And suddenly the deck, you have a lot of room to operate when you're playing against it. And I think that because of that, we underestimated that matchup. The version that DC built was better than the one we were testing against. And we underestimated the resilience that that deck has to even get past the host eventually. The ability to draw into the He Calls It Thinkings using the Viper's Bannerman, which we weren't using as our restricted, and Lost Oasis, which was a money card against us bypassing the host when it was used to give stealth to a character that already had stealth.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree. I think that they did a fantastic job. You know, like, Corey built that deck really, really well. I felt like it was a deck that they took the best parts of a whole bunch of different themes, kind of like a monster they were creating. They said, oh, you know, we really want to have some Gas and Grey, and they got that in. They said, oh, we need some army support, and they got that in. And then they said, you know what else we want? We're going to have some, you know, Quinton Knight stuff, you know, get that in. And they managed to get all these themes working together. And I think a lot of people underestimate. They're like, oh, it's just a standard Quinton deck. I really don't think it is. I think they got this perfect balance of all these different themes working together to create a beast of a deck that did extremely well at the tournament. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, 10 of them brought it. Yeah, well, 8 of them made it to the final with it. That really tells you that it's not just about good players at that point. It's also a really good deck. So, you know, congratulations to Corey for creating a great deck. And I know that it was heavily playtested by the person that ended up taking overall. I think his last name's Simone?
Simone, yes.
Yeah, and he playtested it just hours and hours and hours and hours. And I think between him and Corey, they crafted a fantastic deck that the whole meta got to, you know, take to the finals, basically. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so I felt it was a bad matchup for us. I felt, though, that I played really well. I felt, hey, it was great. I got to teach Eric a couple new rules, so that was good.
Speaking of teaching rules, I think we can't skip the scenario that happened at Gen Con, recounted by Kyle Slansky, who made the cut with his tunnels. Where he was playing against, I believe it was an 8-year-old girl or a 9-year-old girl. So there was a family with a father, his daughter, and his son, and all three of them competed in the tournament. None of them dropped. They all played the whole way through. I saw them the next day. I congratulated them on it. But this girl was a great Thrones player, and she was correcting people four times her age on ruling issues and getting them right. And that's just such a great story.
And they had so much fun. They wanted to come back and play some just pickup games while people were playing the finals, but it was too late because of their bedtime. So their dad finally said, well, we'll see, we'll talk to your mom. And I could see when, you know, he was saying that, it was like, no, this isn't going to happen. You know, it's going to be dinner break, and then we're not coming back at 8:30 so that you guys can play a couple pickup games. So,
incredibly impressed. They played the whole tournament through. They had a smile on their face. The next day, they, you know, were still recounting stories about the tournament between each other. That was just really nice to see them play.
Yeah, I wish I knew their names so we could do a scream out props here on the podcast. But
they would deserve it. I hope someone does remember, and I hope we see them again next year.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a definite up-and-comer. If she sticks with the game, we'll see her, you know, maybe going 3-3 next year, and then the year after we'll see her in top 16. So you played Melee as well, right, Alex?
I did. I played Melee. That's a slightly sadder story for me because I quite enjoy Melee, and I got stuck at 2 3-person tables. My first two tables were 3-person, and that's just... for those of you who don't often play Melee, it's not really a disadvantage from the scoring perspective because they've changed those rules so that actually you're better off at a 3-person table. But what happens is that the way people pick titles, you wind up with no choice in who you can attack if you can attack anyone at all. And so it really, the titles wind up being incredibly constraining in a 3-player game when they're really the meat of a 4-player game.
Yeah, I also got stuck at a three-player table, but luckily it was against the eventual Melee winner, and it was fun enough to play with him, and I managed to convince the other person at our table to gang up on him, so I took that table down. But how'd you do overall in Melee?
I wound up winning one table, tying for second and third, I guess, so technically tying for third at one of my three-man tables, and my very first game, I wound up taking second place with 18 power, 19 power total, and Melisandre had just been brought out of shadows, or brought out of her dead pile with Fiery Kiss. It was one of those, I wound up snatching defeat from the jaws of victory and getting almost no points for it because I let that Melisandre hit the board again just for one phase, and I misplayed that phase. So I didn't make the cut, and I felt, I think, 20th. So I wasn't even all that close to making the cut with 19 points in the end. But I know there was at least one other Canadian in the cut.
I didn't know who else. I made the cut with the Dragon's Deck Weaver.
That was the one.
Okay. Yeah, I made the cut with the Dragon Deck at Melee. So I was playing a Maester Dragon Deck, very similar to the Joust Deck that I won the Rochester Regional with. Basically, popping Balerion in to kneel out people's boards and being able to rush to power very quickly. One game I won on turn one, another I won, all my others I won on turn two. And I won my first two games, and in my third game, I got to see the Sand Snake deck go off. And for those that don't know, there's a combination with Knights of the Hollow Hill for easy influence where you basically kill the Red Viper, no use for grief, get all your Sand Snakes out, nest a Viper, give them all renown, then make them so they don't kneel, and you basically claim all your power. And I got to see that happen at my final table, which was pretty cool to witness and resulted in me taking second. But yeah, so overall, top 16 in both events. I was really happy with that. And then I got to see the deck we worked on go to fourth, so that was great. I got to see the Quinton deck, which I thought was a fantastic deck. Was there any other decks that you saw at the event that you thought jumped out either in Melee or Joust, Alex?
So in Joust, it's worth mentioning, I don't know if this has ever happened at an event this big, there was an Alliance agenda in the top 16. And that was actually my round of top 16 matchup. So that was Francisco from Chile, who was playing a Baratheon Alliance to Lannister. And he had gone 5-1 with a single loss. And, you know, before that matchup, I knew what he was playing, and he knew what I was playing. We had sat next to each other in the first round when he was playing Kennen. And that was an interesting matchup because I thought, hold on, you know, how am I going to milk that agenda to the best of use? Because that's really what you have to do. And I decided, in talking to you, that it would allow me to get two extra gold to potentially get a host from hand in play on turn one if I want to search it out for my deck. And that's what I did, and unfortunately I completely shut his deck down. But I think he was well equipped to take the Quinton decks and to outrush them and outpace them. And for having the guts to take an Alliance deck to top 16, he deserves, you know, some impressive congratulations.
Yeah, that was the one that stuck out in my mind. I also saw a combo deck that sadly didn't work. There was a person that brought a combination that was about 8 pieces long, but basically resulted in unlimited influence, allowing him to continually look at the top card of his own deck and naming it to claim power. And what the combination relied on, however, was the Martell character that when you kneel for influence gets discarded.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know the one.
I can't remember the name of it, but and basically
Starfall Advisor, Starfall Merchant? Merchant, I think.
Merchant, probably, yeah. And basically the idea was he could recycle it, but what he didn't realize that he couldn't recycle it because it was morbid at the time that he was attempting to do his recycle. So basically his whole combination didn't go off.
So to do that, you'd need a second Starfall Merchant. You need one to discard and have hit your discard pile to pay the influence to fetch the other one back. I assume he was using Prince's Plans?
Yes.
Yeah. So so he would need an additional Starfall Merchant to make that combo actually work at that point.
Yeah, it was rather complicated, but that was the basis of the deck, and he was able to win his first game, and then in his second game, he basically realized, well, a judge realized that the combo didn't work because of the morbid rules, and that was his tournament, which was really too bad. Because it was interesting, it's really nice to see that people are thinking outside the box, people are bringing a couple shaggy decks to these tournaments, ones that could probably do well, like Alliance agendas. But sadly, you know, it didn't work in this case, and he said that he was going to try to perfect the deck, and you would see him at Worlds, so I think that would be interesting for those that are going to Worlds. So, talking about Worlds, you know, now that Gen Con's done, what do you think we're going to be seeing at Worlds? There's a lot of chapter packs, obviously, to come. You know, we probably have two or three released before Worlds that it might change the meta drastically. We've seen some spoilers on those. What type of deck do you feel might do well in Worlds, though?
Well, like you say, I think that it's hard to rush to conclusions because there's probably going to be an FAQ between now and then. At least that's the impression that I got. And we're going to get, you know, at least two more chapter packs that we haven't seen the entirety of, one of which is supposed to revamp seasons, which could change how every house works. And then one of which is supposed to revamp shadows, which again is something that can work with almost any house. So I think jumping to conclusions there is a little premature, but I strongly suspect that that we're going to see card advantage be king. I think that was one of the themes here at Gen Con as well, and I think that means that both the Song of Summer or Song of Fire and Song of Ice agendas, which play heavily into the theme of card advantage, will actually be major players at this at Worlds.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think the more I play, the more I realize that every extra card you draw versus your opponent is a huge difference, way bigger than most people think. And we saw that with the Long Voyage, and people have learned from that, and they're playing decks where it's just about card advantage. And basically, that's what the Black Sails deck we played was. It's a different form of card advantage. You search out, and you get that extra draw. And, you know, I think a card that you can choose is better than just a random card, but if you can just draw enough random cards, I'm a happy camper.
And I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes the Viper's Bannerman just such a fantastic restricted card. It's nets you a card when you play it, and then it's this threat that, you know, at any time he can pick up another two cards when it leaves the game, you know, Valor or whatever the case is. And I think that's the reason that the Quentin deck we saw was much stronger than the one we tested against, was just that additional card advantage makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, that was kind of the basis for Kyle's Tunnels deck. You saw him running Pyrospencer's Cache, and he basically just draw capped after turn one from
then
on.
That's right, yeah.
And that was the strength of the deck. It was like, well, can you stop me from draw capping? No, I'm probably going to win versus you then. I just have to be able to hold off maybe one or two rounds for this card advantage to start making a huge difference. So I think you're going to see a lot more of card advantage, like you were saying, at Worlds, and people trying to counter that card advantage in interesting ways, which will play into the winter and summer agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a couple other tournaments that went on over the week since Gen Con, I guess. There was a big Polish event and another event.
Libanfaka, or however people who don't speak French pronounce that word. It probably is a word in English as well.
And what was the other event? Do you know?
The Australian National Tournament.
That's right.
Unfortunately, that wasn't very well attended. The crowd with which we normally interact over Octagon from Melbourne wasn't able to fly out to Sydney to attend that, so it wound up being a 16-person national. However, they brought out some big guns, and I believe the final was a rematch of my top four match. There was a Greyjoy Black Sails about 10 cards different from ours against a Quentin deck that was about two or three cards different from the DC solution. So I got to hear a play-by-play of, you know, my loss again as Quentin took the Australian Nationals.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Greyjoy Black Sails is better against Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill, which Quentin might have a little bit of problems with, but it's a strong deck, totally worth taking to regionals. And I believe the Polish ended up having a Lannister as the winner.
A Lannister No Agenda took that.
Yeah.
Which again, you know, that No Agenda is taking a lot of these tournaments shows that the game is not in the place that you would have expected it to be a year ago. When these character agendas first came out, people thought they were flashy and thought they were going nowhere. And couldn't be further from the truth.
Absolutely. We saw a top four character agenda Greyjoy at Gen Con.
We saw a Kevin deck as well in the top 16 at Gen Con, as well as the vast majority of that top 16 was Quentin. And then we see Quentin take the Australian tournament, and we see Kevin take the Polish one.
So that really does show, you know, especially with the fleets and stuff, it makes people really think, is it worth it to have an agenda here, or is the character agenda better? And a lot of people are deciding it's better to have no agenda.
Yeah, so. And I'm glad that that's a decision point. I feel like there should be an opportunity cost just to running an agenda, and there are more and more cards that make that worthwhile. You know, when Stark is a high presence, people are thinking, okay, Northern Cavalry Flank and Damon Dance for me, or things like that. And then when, you know, the fleets are out in force, people are going, okay, do I really want to give them that edge, especially in the early game where they can play something, for, you know, strength 7 for only 4? Or if I delay that by 2 turns, by the time I have my character agendas an agenda, I can control things and I can set the tempo. And I think it's an interesting decision.
Yeah, and I think it's great that they have this decision. I really like where the game is going in general. You know, if I had to cry about one thing, I would just say the amount of draw. We keep seeing more and more little things being added to draw, and as we were talking about, draw is, you know, the king in this game, so the more draw you give to, you know, we'll say the draw houses of Martell and Lannister, I think the more we're going to see these houses get stronger and stronger.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point for those of you who play the Star Wars LCG or play Netrunner or these other games by Fantasy Flight that have come out since. They all have very clear mechanics with regards to card advantage to avoid the situation that we have here in Thrones. And so I think the meta right now is wide open. I think we've got more, you know, tons of deck variety. We have a lot of interesting decks. We got a nice deep card pool, and I'm really enjoying it. But in the fairly far distance, I think that one of the issues is that there has to be something to rein the supremacy of card advantage in, and I don't know how they're going to go about doing that.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but it's interesting. It's definitely something I'm sure the developers are thinking about, and you know, the only other thing I think they probably have on their minds, as we saw from one of their posts, is that the entry into the game is getting more and more difficult for new players. And it's something I struggle with pretty regularly. You know, got a lot of rules to teach people. The core set isn't the best entry point, I find. It, you know, doesn't give them a playable deck that they can take to their local, you know, game shop and just sit down and play versus someone else in a joust. And because of that, it's probably not the best entry point. But
well, I think the typical example is anyone who looks at the Targaryen core deck and tries to figure out what it's supposed to do. And I'm a fairly experienced player, and I still haven't figured out what that deck's supposed to do.
Yeah, I keep thinking, well, maybe they just wanted to introduce everything Targ can do. There's a little burn, a little ambush.
That's right, a little bit.
I have to figure out what the point of the deck is, and for a new player to kind of struggle with that doesn't give them a good flavor to the game. But, you know, other than that, we're seeing better turnouts than ever, so obviously more and more people are playing. Even around here in Canada, the Montreal meta and the Toronto meta are expanding, so we're seeing more and more tournaments with more and more players, which is just awesome. It's getting way more competitive than it was, you know, 2 years ago, and I'm really happy with that. So I think the game's in a good place, and I bet Worlds is just going to be super fun. I really wish I could go, but I can't. Before Worlds, however, there's going to be a tournament in October in New York. I want to do a shout-out for all those New Yorkers that are running that event. If you're in the area or you're thinking of going, take a look at the post. And, yeah, Oktoberfest, New York, Game of Thrones style.
And I think October also has a fairly major French tournament in Lille, I think, which is basically their lead-up to Stalag in November. So I think there's one more big European tournament before Stalag. So there's, for those of you who happen to be traveling in Europe, you should certainly look that up.
But, I mean, if you're a Game of Thrones player and traveling in Europe, you should really hold off until November so you can go to Stalag.
And go to Stalag. Stay in a castle.
Yeah.
Play Game of Thrones in the biggest Game of Thrones event worldwide and compete for some really nice prizes. Yeah.
For sure. You know, I'm hoping Worlds in a, you know, this year or next year or the year after will crack that. I mean, maybe with 104 people showing up to Gen Con, but man, Stalic has been, you know, the King of Thrones for so long, and I wish I had the time, energy, and money to fly out there and play.
Speaking of growing thrones at Worlds, one of the things the developers or the FFG employees mentioned this year was that they were in talks with the distributor in China that wants to be able to send their national champion next year to Worlds. So they're still looking to get that kind of support. Already the European distributors are able to do that and able to send their champions over for Worlds. And now they're starting to work with the Asian ones. So that would be great for Worlds. It'll make Worlds more of a world event.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think China just finally caught up to us in chapter packs. So now
they got the last cycle, that's right. They got the Return of the Others, or the Defenders of the North, sorry, I think 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and their meta is so different than a lot of the other, even the European metas. They have really interesting builds. I think it'd be really cool to see some of their players come over here and play in the Worlds. So that's it for Summer is Coming.